Thank you for joining us today for a message from the Word of God. What follows is a recording from one of our live services at Gooch Lane Church of Christ in Huntsville, Alabama. If you're ever in the area, we'd love to have you join us in person. And if you like what you hear today, you can visit us online at teachingtruth.org, where we have videos, weekly articles on biblical topics, information about our services, and more.
If you'd like, you can go ahead and turn over to Psalm 24. We'll be spending just about all of our time here this morning in this psalm. Several months ago, there was a major event that took place with the passing of Queen Elizabeth II. A lot of news stories about that, a lot of broadcast about it, her history and such. I suspect she was one of the most beloved monarchs of modern times for sure, but maybe of all times. And there might be a lot of reasons for that. She certainly was a symbol of Great Britain. She had been around a long time. She had lived through a lot of the significant events of recent years with Great Britain. But I imagine there was another reason she was so popular. It's because she had no authority. And so really, you have the best possible world. You've got regality, but no authority. She can't tell you what to do. Because most people in the world don't care a great deal for monarchies that are authoritative. Kings or queens that are telling you what to do. And for sure, that's the case in the United States. When you trace back our heritage, that we fought a war to end a monarchy's control over us and replaced with a Republican, small r Republican form of government, where we get to decide what it is we want and who we want to lead us. And that may be okay for America, but it's not okay for the people of God. One of the things that God insists upon in our recognition of Him is His place as King in our lives. And Psalm 24 is a magnificent portrayal of that. And I really appreciate the songs that Greg picked out this morning. They have primed us for our study that as we have sung these great songs about the King, and as even putting this particular psalm to music and singing it, it's a reminder to us of that great King. But yet in this psalm, David says, I want to show you what it looks like when God and the human come together. What's expected? What should we be looking for in that, and how should we present ourselves? I'd like for us to focus on that this morning. And so as we begin this study, let's think about just the idea of Yahweh, Jehovah God, as being our King. As the Bible opens, God does not introduce Himself in so many words as the King. Now put a little asterisk by that. We're going to be back to that point here in a minute. Rather, what He does is He reveals to us on the very first page of the Bible His role as our Creator. So we take that concept from Genesis, and then we go to the book of Psalms, and what we see in the book of Psalms is that the psalmist prominently display God as King. In fact, many of these psalms we could have picked out this morning to make very similar points to the ones we're going to be talking about. But the psalmist very majestically lift Him up and say, when you think about Jehovah God, you are thinking about not the King of a nation, but the King of everyone. Yet they do. They take that idea of kingship and they merge it with the Genesis 1 idea of Creator. And they say the reason He is worthy to be considered your King, the reason why He is deserving of your service, is because He is your Creator. And thus within the book we have the merger and the creation of the idea of the Creator King. Let's look at our psalm here, the first two verses of introduction. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. For He has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. Taking the idea of Genesis, where God pulls the creation out of the chaotic waters and founds it, David here writes that we belong to Him, as does everything in this world, because He is our Creator. And as we've mentioned, numerous other psalms will bear this out. But let's take it a step further. What David is going to show us within this psalm is that he is not only the Creator King, but he's also very concerned about a relationship with his creation. Now, here's where the kingship of God differs with a lot of earthly monarchs. You could think about someone like Elizabeth II, or for that matter, Elizabeth I either, who were very much people-oriented queens. They were out there amongst the people. But many of the monarchs that we look at through world history were not. In fact, they would keep themselves very isolated and back and had no real interest in anything that was going on in the lives of their subjects other than the full 100% obedience. That's not God. That while God does want our obedience and desires it, He also wants to have a relationship with us. And what this psalm is going to show is the commitment to that, the commitment to His relationship with the created. God would be worthy of our worship regardless of His opinion on us. He's the Creator. He owns us. But what makes it so much better is to know that we were created for a purpose, and that purpose was to have a relationship with Him. And because of that, He's interested in what we've got to say. So here's a king who is not isolated behind some wall and moat, who is unapproachable, who doesn't care anything about us. Here is a king who has called on us to speak with Him. Let's stray for just a minute into another psalm, and we see that. In Psalm chapter 5, the psalmist writes, "Give attention to the sound of my cry, my King and my God, for to you do I pray." Prayer is not a conversation. It's not going to be where I say something and God answers me back, but rather it's approaching the throne of the King, where God is saying to me, "I am giving you permission, and not only that, I'm giving you encouragement to come before me and to pour your heart out to me, to let me know what's going on in your mind, to make your petitions to me." That's the kind of King that we're serving. This great Creator King who cares for us. So after that introduction, David is now going to talk about how we approach this King. As we've noted already, we are created to be the King's servants. I don't know that that idea is one that we keep at the forefront of our minds. We talk about serving God. But do we fully appreciate the idea that we were created to be His servants? That's an interesting thought when you think about our creation. That it's as if the King of all called us out of the dust, breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, so that we could be servants to Him. But here's the thing we've got to understand with that. It's not this chattel service. It's not that God has created us as some kind of ogre who doesn't want to do anything and He's given us all the work to do, like so often characterizes servants and masters. Instead, on the very first page of Genesis, God introduces the creation of humanity as royal servants, as those who were called into His service and were given great responsibility for the things that He desires. In fact, that's what Psalm 8 is going to tell us about. When in verse 5 the psalmist writes, "You have made Him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned Him with glory and honor. You have given Him dominion over all the works of your hands. You have put all things under His feet, all sheep and oxen and all the beasts of the field." Almost a direct quote from Genesis 1. Where the psalmist says, you've created humanity for this divine purpose, but I want you to pay particular attention this morning to where he says, you have given Him dominion. That D-O-M at the beginning is the idea of authority, kind of like what we find at the end of kingdom. So here, the great King of the universe, the great King of all, has said, I have called you into my service, and I'm going to share my authority with you. I've created this earth. I've made this wonderful creation, and what I desire is for you to rule with me. I'm going to give you dominion. So here we are, humanity, called for this great purpose that we can be servants to the living God, to the great King. And that should take away any notion in our mind that we are insignificant to God. That should take away any notion that God has somehow created us just to be angry and mean and cruel to us. Not at all. He's created us for a royal purpose, which means we've got to respond accordingly. And as we have been called into the King's service, we give Him honor, and we give Him obedience, and we represent Him well. Every once in a while, I get kind of on a royal reading kick. And I'll read some of the biographies of ancient kings, or maybe even some not so ancient. And what's always interesting is to see who they could count on. Because in the king's court, those earthly kings would never quite know who was on their side and who wasn't. But yet there would be a small inner circle that the king could count on, who in every situation they were doing the king's bidding, they were honoring his position, they were obedient to him, not rebelling, and when they went out in his name, they were presenting him in a very good way. That's exactly what God wants for us. He says, as my royal servants, I have given you authority, and what I desire now is for you to give me honor, that in your dealings with others, in your dealings with me, that you are showing this respect that's deserving of the great King of heaven. So then, here we are called to be servants. Here we all are given this royal purpose in our lives. But then David continues and he says, let's talk about how you as a royal servant come before God. So we go down into verse 3. And he says, who shall ascend the hill or the mountain of the Lord? And who shall stand in His holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false, and does not swear deceitfully. That idea of ascending the mountain of the Lord is a big one in the book of Psalms. And there's two ways of looking at that. For the psalmists, surely many of them had in mind approaching the temple. When you would go to Jerusalem and as you went up that mountain and you're seeing the temple before you, if you are a spiritually minded Jew, you're a reminder that this is the meeting place of God and man. But if you think about it in a broader sense, that temple is representing Eden, the perfect place of God and man coming together. And so perhaps David is merging those ideas when he says, let's talk about who can approach the Lord. The Lord wants you to. The Lord wants this relational situation with you. He wants you to be in His presence. But let's talk about how you do it. And David says, first of all, you've got to have clean hands and you've got to have a pure heart. And what he's meaning by that is when you come into the presence of the king, what that means is that your thoughts, your motives must be pure, and that purity is going to be seen in the actions that you carry out. Isn't it interesting that many, many years later, the writer James is going to pick up that same idea when he says, draw near to God and He will draw near to you. But how? Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. I think James has likely got Psalm 24 playing on the radio, doesn't he? This is the idea that the psalmist, that David, is trying to get across, where he's saying, if you are going to come into the presence of the king, you got to realize this is a really big deal. And there are lots of responsibilities, but primarily, you got to make sure you're a loyal subject. that in your loyalty you have no ill against this king. You have no desire for his harm. And in your loyalty, your actions are going to demonstrate it. Your work is for his glory. And he continues on. And he says, not lifting up the soul. When we look at soul in the Bible, that's somewhat of a challenging word to pin down, isn't it? Yet really, I think what we've got going on here is you've got our entirety being brought into the picture. Body and spirit coming together. And this is who we are, this living soul before God. Everything about us, he says, there can be nothing false about you. There can be nothing vain about you. There's no deceit found in your mouth. There's no playing the hypocrite. No, you're coming before him clean in thought and in motive. And you're coming before him recognizing him and him alone as the great King of heaven. And he says, when you can do this, you're ready to ascend the mountain of the Lord. And let's see what he says then in verses 5 and 6. The one who does this, he says, he will receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob. God says, when you come before me with pure heart and clean hands and pure motive, not lifting up your soul, I am here to be found. And from me you're going to receive blessing and righteousness, and you'll receive salvation. That's a beautiful picture. But yet what you and I realize is that there is the ever-present danger that we do not have pure hands nor a pure heart, that our soul is lifted up to our own glory. And we might just say with this, rather than enthroning God, instead there's this very great temptation to enthrone ourselves, to put ourselves in that place that belongs to God. So often when things happen in our culture, we'll say, I just don't understand why that's happening. It doesn't make sense. I would suggest that any time we start to enthrone ourselves, we make that same statement. This does not make sense for me to do this. To try to remove God from that position of honor that he has and try to put myself there instead. Here's our human problem. It's seeking to dethrone God. And so you take all of this combined, and what it's showing is that though we were called to be servants of God, instead we're trying to be the master. We're trying to put ourselves in this position to where God and God alone belongs. That's beyond what we are. And that goes well beyond the reason for our created purpose. We know that the danger is always found in trying to please ourselves. When we go all the way back to the very beginning, this is the common link of every sin that every human has committed. Those sins are varied, many, many different ways that they've been demonstrated, but it all goes back to the idea that I am putting myself in charge instead of God. And it's the idea that I am going to do what I believe is the right thing. All the way back to Adam and Eve. All the way into the present with us. That when we go against the king, what we're saying is, I don't trust that what you've told me is the right thing to do. I've got a better idea. And when you and I do that, we're putting ourselves in charge. We're enthroning our own selves before God. And so what David is emphasizing to us in Psalm 24 is that if I'm going to meet the king, then there can be nobody or no other thing that I'm putting on the throne. It's God and God alone. And it's that I recognize. We then have a change of tone within the psalm. Still regal, still meeting God. But thus far, David's been telling us how to approach God. Now, as he kind of shifts toward the ending section of the psalm, he says, let's talk about preparing for the king's arrival. We've talked about you meeting the king. Now let's talk about when the king is coming to meet you. And really interesting writing technique that he uses here. Some have suggested maybe this is kind of antiphonal, that as the psalm was being sung, you'd have one portion of the audience singing the verses that you see on the screen in blue, and then another portion of the audience being would answer in what you see in red there. But I want you to note just the repetition that he's bringing out in this. He says, lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is the King of glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. And then we have the repetition. Lift up your heads, O gate, and lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. And the question again asks, who is the King of glory? The Lord of hosts, He is the King of glory. I want you to note something else interesting in this writing. There's a key word that pops when you look at it here. Throughout this section, he talks about lifting up. Lift up your heads, be lifted up, O ancient doors. Lift up your heads and lift them up, O ancient doors, repeated again in the refrain. And when you look earlier in the psalm, when we were talking about meeting the king, David explicitly said, the one who's allowed to meet the king is the one who does not lift up his soul to be one who is false and deceitful. And so you've got this thread running through the psalm of lifting. In the one case, don't lift up yourselves. Don't exalt yourselves. But in the other case, you've got this idea of the gates and the doors being lifted up. There are a lot of those who study the book of Psalms who say that this psalm may have been written in the occasion of the Ark of the Covenant coming in to Jerusalem. I don't know if that's right or not. But it certainly would make sense, wouldn't it? As you think about David finally getting it right, and the psalm is expressing this idea of the gate swinging open as the ark comes in. Regardless of that, though, I just want you to picture the sight that David is trying to create in our minds. That here is a city, and the great king of the universe is coming in. And this king is so glorious. This king is so expansive that you've got to stretch the gates as wide open as possible to allow his glory to come in. And so here is a city that's welcoming. Here is a city that's preparing itself. But it's a little bit of a surprise in the psalm, isn't it, how this king is described? We might expect a lot of terms like glory and majesty and regality. Yet what do we find? Strong and mighty. Mighty in battle. The Lord of hosts or the Lord of armies. We have these very militaristic terms being used that as the gates are being opened wide and the gates are lifted up high, the ancient doors are lifted up high, it's a king who's coming in who is presented great in battle and victorious. And so the picture that David presents then is the city that is welcoming this king in, not fighting against him. Contrast this with Jericho, when Israel was coming in and they've closed the gates and they've shuttered the windows and they're all tightened up. And yet here is the city that has flung the gates open wide to allow this great God, the victorious creator king of the universe, to gain entry into its city. But yet we can also take that and personalize it. And the royal servant who has been called into the service of the great creator king throws open the doors of his or her own heart to welcome this king as the king in whom we confess our trust and our allegiance. Here is the one who is our undisputed king, and all other sovereignty is renounced. Oftentimes when you change your citizenship, part of that is you renounce who you used to be. You say, I've got allegiance to no one else but to this country. David says, when the great king comes into your city, that's what you do also. He is the king. The throne is reserved totally for him. And when we think about that in our own lives, what we're saying is, I'm going to allow no one or nothing else to be placed on that throne but the great king. And so instead of a soul lifted up in haughtiness, the head is lifted up in very loyal allegiance to this king. But here's what we've got to understand about that. This is not a one-time confession. When you and I decide to become Christians, we make our confession public. We'll stand before those who are present, but primarily we're standing before the Lord. And we say, I believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, who died for my sin. But that's only the beginning. Confession is something that goes throughout our lives. That every time we have the opportunity to show ourselves pure and our motives pure, we confess Jesus as the great King. We confess Yahweh as the Creator of the universe. As I was preparing for this lesson, I came across an old hymn. It was written in 1642 in Germany. Somewhere along the way, someone translated it into English. I've never heard it sung before. But I was particularly taken by one of the verses where the writer said, "Fling wide the portals of your heart. Make it a temple set apart from earthly use for heaven's employ, adorned with prayer and love and joy." That whole hymn was about Psalm 24. And I think that hymnist got it. That if you and I are going to be the people, the servants of the great King, and to serve Him as we should, then everything in our life has got to be centered around Him. There's nothing secular. And so I think about my family life. I think about my marriage. I think about the vows I've taken. I think about my kids. I think about my work associates. I think about everything in this regard. And so whenever I have the opportunity, what I'm doing is showing who my King is. That's what this whole psalm is about. That I'm welcoming Him in, but I'm also letting everyone who comes within my sphere of influence to know exactly to whom I belong. That's what it means to make a life long confession. So how do we do this? Well, if we take this psalm in its entirety, it means that every decision I make is made in light of my respect for the King. Let me repeat that. Every decision that I make is made in light of respect for the King. How I conduct myself in my job, how I conduct myself with my neighbors, how I spend my money, the words that I choose to use, everything is brought under His purview if He is the King who is enthroned in my heart. And I trust that the King's way is the right way. Remember what we said about the commonality of all sin? It's thinking that my way is best. It's trusting that in everything, God is right. This beautiful psalm spoke a wonderful message to those who read it in kind of its real-time writing, and to countless others over the years who've read it. But this psalm holds a special significance for those on this side of the cross. Because as we look at that psalm, we can see within it the tones of the coming of the Messiah, the Anointed One, who God has prophesied will and did come. Jesus proves Himself to be the ultimate human, as well as the ultimate King. As a human, He meets the requirements for ascending the mountain of the Lord. His motives were innocent. His words were honest. as King. He's mighty and He's strong and He's victorious. And so as you and I read this psalm, what we're finding is a picture that's being presented of the One who masterfully demonstrates to us what it looks like when the King and the human meet, quite literally. The One who was 100% human and 100% God. That's who we see. And as we read it in that light, we see how He stands in contrast to our flawed reasoning. To a people who have been corrupted by sin, to a people who've gone astray to their own way, we look at Him and we see the very perfect One, the One who we want to imitate, the One who we want to be like. But I want to direct your attention back to verse 5. Where the psalmist writes, David writes, He will receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of His salvation. That although we desire to be like this King, we realize we have fallen way short of that. And yet, here is the great King who desires such a relationship with us that He says, I am going to provide the way of salvation for you. To reach My holy mountain. And so the warrior king fought and was victorious. Here was the One who fought death and won. Here is the One who is welcomed into the city as the victorious King who has returned from the grave, defeating death, defeating wickedness. And here is the loving King who offers the rebels a way back home. Every once in a while in those royal readings, you come across a very benevolent king who maybe there's been an uprising, and that king will say, I'm granting amnesty. Come back in, no penalty. And yet even an action like that pales so in comparison to when we think about the King of all, who called us into being so that we could be His royal servants and exercise dominion with Him, who left that, who went off into the ways of sin, where He says, I am so interested in you coming back that I'll take on your flesh and I'll die and I'll defeat death so that you can have a place with Me. Here is the One who promises that if we will be those reformed rebels, that we'll come back into loyal service with Him, He says, I'll not only welcome you back, I'll give you back your royal position. And as Paul wrote to Timothy, so He says to us, if we endure, we will also reign with Him. The great King has called us for great things. That we'll know here, but that we'll also know eternally in whatever it is that He has planned for us in that eternal action that He has so promised. So I encourage you this morning that you surrender to the King. The terms are very favorable. The King says, all the rebellion, tell you what I'll do. I'll drop it to the bottom of the sea. I'll put it as far from Me as east is from west. And through My grace, you're going to see the love that I have for you. That far from being an angry God who's trying to exact His pound of flesh, instead, what I've done for you is given you a way of escape to come back over to My side, where you can not only be a part of My family now and can serve Me now, but that's going to go on eternally. What an offer this King makes. But it is on His terms. He says, you've got to renounce yourself. You've got to stop being loyal to whatever it is that's keeping you from Me. Put that away. Meet My grace in the waters of baptism, where I'll wash away your sins and we'll start over again. And I'll raise you up in newness of life to walk with Me now and forever. If you're not a Christian, that's a mighty big offer to turn down, isn't it? Maybe you're struggling It happens. Not every loyal servant to the king has 100% loyalty. There's times when temptations come, and maybe you're there, and we can pray for your strength this morning, or maybe you've fallen. And we can go with you to the great king for forgiveness. And the great thing about this great king is he says, that's exactly what I want you to do. Because I want to forgive you. I want you to be a part of this family. That's how David felt when he penned this poem. It's how the Jews felt when they sang it. And that's how we can feel today on this side of the cross, where we see the completed plan and all that God has done for our salvation. If you need to respond to this great king this morning, you can come while we stand and sing together.
Thanks again for joining us today. If you have questions about anything you heard today or anything Bible related, you can use the contact form on our website at teachingtruth.org to submit a question and someone will be in touch. There's also lots of other great Bible content on our site as well. The web address again is teachingtruth.org. Once again, thanks for listening, and we hope to see you in person soon.